available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. I'm Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on the 17th of September 2025. Coming up, we're looking at shore crabs, the seaside charmers. Once again, steam trains come into the programme. We're at Napton Hill in Warwickshire and Warwick Folk Festival, and we're looking at some of the classic TV ads from the past. All that coming up, of course, plus our usual features of postbag sport and everything else. And first of all, we're going to start with the news from our readers, Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
A new bus gate in Coventry city centre, which became operational on September the 8th, has provoked considerable discussion, with many locals questioning access, signage and the impact on the city centre. Situated on Greyfriars Road, it is part of plans which also include a pop-up cycle lane. And if any listener can enlighten the news team as to what a pop-up cycle lane is, we'd be pleased to know. A council spokesperson said, "A new bus gate has been introduced on Greyfriars Road, alongside a red route, to aid the flow of traffic and buses around the city centre. For drivers on the Ring Road, it means Junction 7 is the junction to use for access to Lower Precinct and the Sky Dome, while Junction 6 by Central 6 is the route for the Wave and the Bullyard area. Inevitably, there will be some who still use the road as has been the norm. So while everyone gets used to the bus gate, we will be adding extra signage and only sending warning letters for the first month or so. The council hopes this initiative will demonstrate that Coventry Very Light Rail is a fantastic new transport option, optimising the use of the Ring Road and reducing traffic in residential areas. This means there should be less traffic in the more residential city centre areas, including those on Queen Victoria Road, creating a more pedestrian-friendly environment." One Coventrian commented, "Here we go again. We have had more bus gates than I can count. They come and they go at the whim of the council. Another road closed to traffic, strangling an already dying city centre." This was corroborated when others stated, "I just find it easier and less complicated now to never venture inside the Ring Road." And another said, "That is one place I try to avoid, and now they've got a bike lane that will not be used." Another said, "Am I missing something? Wasn't the point of the VLR to reduce the need for buses? So why is there a need for a bus gate at this location? Installing a bus gate has nothing to do with VLR. It's just another of the creeping restrictions in the centre of the city and a source of revenue. The Ring Road is busy enough without forcing confused motorists to follow confusing signage. The whole cycle lane policy is an absolute failure in Coventry, almost always empty, and the one near me is just full of mess. But an alternative view was, it is very residential on Greyfriars Road, so I suppose it is good news if you live there."
A neighbourhood police station facility in Coventry, where people can speak to officers face to face, has reopened to the public a decade after it closed. Willenhall Police Station's public contact office closed in May 2015, but reopened last Wednesday, September the 10th. The site on Chase Avenue officially became Coventry Police's headquarters following a refurbishment in September 2024, and many Coventry PCs are now based at the newly revamped facility. The facility, which also had a refurbished custody suite and new cells installed this year, will be open daily between 9 o'clock and 5 in the afternoon. Chief Superintendent Paul Joyce, responsible for policing across Coventry, said, "We have been without the front office for several years, and it is an absolute pleasure now to be reopening this facility to enable the public to come and talk to us face to face." Chief Constable Greg Guildford said that public contact offices were a key component of the force's police station. "While it is people and not bricks which keep neighbourhoods safe, I recognise their iconic status within communities," he said. "They make people feel reassured. It is a fact that most people prefer to call us or go online these days," he explained, "but there are some transactions which remain best done face to face, and some are often sensitive depending on need." The opening of Willen Hall brings the total number of public contact offices across the West Midlands to 11. In the year ending September 2024, Coventry recorded a crime rate below the average seen in comparable areas across the UK and below the West Midlands average. More than 6,500 crimes were reported face-to-face over the 12-month period from August 2024 to July 2025.
A Coventry man used his love of his city's history as a springboard for a victorious performance on Mastermind this week. Eric Davis sat opposite host and quizmaster Clive Myrie in Monday night's episode of the long-running BBC Two quiz show. Eric's specialist topic was the history of Coventry. He surged to an early joint lead, answering every one of his questions correctly, bar one. He later consolidated this performance with a strong general knowledge round, meaning he progressed to the semi-final and a shot at the coveted Mastermind glass bowl. Eric, who is a consultant neuropsychologist, answered questions spread across 1,000 years of Coventry history, including topics such as the city's coat of arms, industry, and figures and buildings through the ages. He said after his win, "To win Mastermind is something that hard to achieve. You are up against really stern opposition. So to come through it is really great. It's also a bit of a relief. It was great to be in the lead at half time, but it's really important not to be premature with these things. I'm a big football fan, and I know it ain't over till the ref blows the whistle." He added, "It's an imposing environment. For part of my work, I go into court, and there are some parallels between Mastermind and the courtroom. Both pretty stern and forbidding environments. I chose the history of Coventry, as I think roots and where you're from are really important. I'm still fond of the city. My mum still lives here. I'm a season ticket holder of Coventry City FC. It's great to be able to learn more about it, because you always find out more than you thought you knew. Mastermind is iconic. It would be great to win the glass bowl, but it's also quite an achievement. And if you did not see the episode on Monday, it is available on iPlayer."
Celebrations are being planned to mark the 60th anniversary of Plus Dolly Mock, Coventry City Council's outdoor education centre in North Wales. And next year's anniversary will also see council chiefs engage with schools and communities about their future ideas for the listed building in the heart of Snowdonia. Plas Dolly Mock is a 17th century country house set in gardens and woodlands in the Vale of Festiniog. It has 87 beds spread between the main house and a converted stable block. A report from the council's head of education, entitlement and enrichment services said that the celebrations in 2026 would mark an important milestone for the city and its residents, many of whom have spent time at the centre. The report says, "The anniversary provides an opportunity not only to celebrate the unique contribution the centre has made to generations of Coventry children and families, but also to reaffirm its role in shaping the city's future through outdoor education and access to green space." It goes on to explain that there will be three key strands to events marking the occasion: the past, the present and the future. Stories and photographs will be shared from visits dating all the way back to 1966, and schools and communities will be given the chance to shape the next phase with opportunities to expand access to outdoor education and to ensure its long-term sustainability. The centre comes under the banner of Coventry Outdoors, together with the In-City Outdoor Education Service at Coombe Abbey, which was launched in 2021. The service, including overheads, is fully funded from income and grants, and the bill came to around £1.8 million in the last financial year. Councillors at Thursday, September 11th Education and Children's Services Scrutiny Board meeting also considered renovation work needed at the Grade 2 listed Welsh property. This includes creating ensuite staff accommodation, improved student living spaces, and a reconfigured internal layout better to support residential outdoor learning and flexible group bookings. In addition, a new multi-purpose building is being considered, which would include additional staff accommodation.
When Molly Cavanna from Coventry first became a football referee 4 years ago, female officials were a rarity, but now times are changing. The 19-year-old began in football as a goalkeeper before she progressed to coaching and eventually found her passion as a sports official. In 2023, the FA launched a 3-year strategy to grow the number of women referees in the game, a move that has already made a difference on the pitch. "I've met so many different inspirational women that I'm really happy to work with," Molly said, adding that a recent game boasted a team of 4 female officials. "There is definitely a pressure there, but at the end of the day you just have to try your best to get the decision right." Molly has progressed to now being able to officiate men's matches in level 6 of the English football pyramid, as well as in the Women's National League. She said the testing journey to become a referee included a number of matches that had to be observed, alongside development days and a fitness test that has been newly introduced this season. Currently, there are 3,425 female match day officials in England, almost 1,000 more than 2 years ago. When asked what advice she had for young women considering the pathway, she said, "Not everyone will share your opinion, but when first I started out, my dad always said, it is a game of opinions, and the only one that matters is yours."
Dramatists have tackled subjects from a UK dystopia to the life of a dominatrix in plays to be showcased this weekend. Coventry's Albany Theatre received funds from the Arts Council to put on a weekend celebrating local talent. 3 new plays will be shown on Saturday and Sunday in the Spotlight Studio Theatre. The 2-day festival, called In the Spotlight, is the first major public showcase led by the new theatre director Alan Pollock, who grew up in the city. He said he wanted to inspire more people in Coventry to explore their creative talents. "We hear a lot about discovering new voices," he said, "but what I'm really interested in are Coventry voices and Midland stories." He said the interest was good at spotting talent, but it needed to be sustained. "As a Coventry kid myself," he said, "this is exactly the kind of work I believe in, offering meaningful platforms, nurturing creative careers, and helping our city's talent to shine." Rugby-based writer Siobhan Healy has written Unleashed, which applies raw honesty and wit to themes of shame and sexuality. Lara J. West from Earlsdon has created a one-woman musical called One Kiss, which featured at the Edinburgh Fringe. Both of these will be performed on Saturday. The 3rd play, At Last, will close the festival on Sunday, following a question and answer session with a creative panel. At Last has been billed as a haunting new play, directed by Walsgrave-born David Brady, and exploring the aftermath of a far-right government's fall after 10 years in office. The studio theatre was created as part of the Albany's £3 million redevelopment, which was completed in 2024.
Residents are being warned of delays to bin collections. It comes as a major waste site closes for 2 weeks from Monday, September the 15th. When household bins are collected, the rubbish is usually deposited at the waste-to-energy plant off London Road. However, the site will be closed for 2 weeks while routine maintenance is completed. Crews will instead be taking household waste to a facility in Bubbenhall. Additional lorries will be used to minimise disruption over the two-week period. Collections are likely to be delayed until Monday, September the 29th. If any bins are missed, they will be emptied the following day, the council says. Bins used for recycling and garden waste will be unaffected, and scheduled collection days will stay the same. A spokesperson for Coventry City Council said, "When household waste bins are collected, the waste is taken to London Road. Every 2 years, the site closes for routine maintenance for 2 weeks. It means that green-lidded bin collection rounds may take longer than usual. We will provide additional drivers and vehicles to help prevent disruption, but some residents may not get their household waste emptied on their scheduled day. Just leave your bin out and the crew will return the following day to ensure that it is emptied."
Residents living on the edge of Coventry say that they have endured a 3-year nightmare trying to tackle a sewage overflow problem, which is causing something of a stink. A huge pool of raw sewage sits constantly on a bend on Parrott's Grove near Alderman's Green. Not only is it damaging the grass verge and a private fence, but last year it iced over, leading to 2 car crashes in the space of an hour. According to one local resident, the problem began when a new permanent traveller site was set up down the road near Barnacle. It is claimed that insufficient underground plumbing is now unable to accommodate the increase in demand, which has led to the overflow. The resident explained, "It's been an ongoing thing for 3 years. I've rung around. Coventry City Council, Warwickshire, they're all at a complete waste of space. I've been told they can't just shut it off because then it would flood the other side. It goes into a ditch and then onto the road. If you look at the fence and the hedge, it's damaging both. I don't think we should have to put up with this, not for 3 years. And there's the smell as well. If you drive up towards Bulkington or Barnacle, you notice it even that far down. People there have told us that they can smell it. But it's not just smell and damage causing a problem. It's dangerous too," the resident continued. "One morning last winter, a girl came driving round the corner, hit the ice, spun and crashed into our fence. While I was ringing the police, another car came round and crashed on the opposite side, all within about half an hour. The roads just haven't been maintained properly. The curb has more or less disappeared. When surplus water is piped into the drain, it just makes things worse." A Warwickshire County Council spokesman responded, "We are aware of the concerns raised and have been actively engaging with all parties involved to help resolve the issue. Site visits and additional drainage work are scheduled to take place over the next 2 weeks, and we are hopeful that these measures will now resolve the situation."
A 91-year-old great-grandfather from Coventry has hired a personal trainer in an attempt to keep up with his grandchildren. Rhys Williams played squash until he was 70, tennis until he was 80, and celebrated his 90th birthday with a ski trip. In the last year, he had found himself slowing down, so decided to sign up to regular fitness sessions with an instructor. He said he knew he would have to give up one day, but asked, "Why not put it off as long as you can?" He was inspired to get into fitness after finding it more difficult to get up and do daily tasks, such as going upstairs or getting in and out of a chair. "I thought, well, it can only get worse unless I do something to try and make it better." Personal trainer Sophie Kennedy said she spent a lot of sessions with Mr. Williams listening to his stories. She said people who she told about her client were quite surprised and also inspired by the fact that someone who is 91 is still working with a personal trainer and focusing on their fitness and their health. He's very impressive and he just gets on with it. Mr. Williams does not have any fitness goals, but said, "I just want to keep up with the grandchildren, or nearly keep up with them, for as long as I can."
A charity in Coventry is currently closed for donations due to its warehouse being flooded. Clothing Coventry on Napier Street in Hillfields helps those in clothing poverty with second-hand clothing, shoes and accessories. The charity has remained closed since the start of this month due to the damage to its clothing stock. It has warned people to hold on to donations until the team can dry the clothes and stop the flooding. The charity said, "We will need to replace much clothing in a couple of weeks. Please hold on to donations until we can dry things out. The warehouse remains open for those in need, though, to come and collect clothes." The CEO of Clothing Coventry, Kate Wilson, said that half the warehouse had been flooded from a sudden downpour, which damaged stock and kitchen cupboards. She described the situation as quite bad. "At the moment, we're trying to work out exactly what we can do, what's wet, what's savable, and trying to just sweep all the water out. We hope that some kind donors will come and support us and help us get through this, as it's an unexpected cost for a small charity and we just don't have the funds." The charity recently opened a pop-up school uniform bank over the summer holiday period to help families who struggle to buy brand new school uniforms for the start of the academic year. They added that they will post on their social media when the warehouse will be open again for donations, but a date has yet to be confirmed.
Local winners in the annual Make a Difference Awards were named and celebrated last weekend. Here at the Hub, we have the great privilege to congratulate Dave Monks, who won the Great Neighbour Award. Dave said it was absolutely wonderful to be recognised, and the Hub will be saying more about this later. Other winners in or near Coventry included 91-year-old Mavis Winterburn, who won the Volunteer Award. Mavis has washed the kits of her local football team, Philongley FC, for the past 75 years and also runs knit and natter groups, presumably not for the football team. "We've done well, really. If anybody wants to learn to knit, they come and we help them out," she said. They knitted life-size soldiers for VE Day, and her next project is a life-size Santa for Christmas. The Animal Award winners were Valerie and dog Rosie. Valerie said, "It's wonderful, it really is. I'm so proud of Rosie and the work she does in Bilton Junior School." Rosie is part of a Pets as Therapy Read to Dog scheme. She goes into the school every Wednesday, and a group of six children each spend around 15 minutes individually reading to Rosie. There are lots of children around. They all come up and want to stroke Rosie. She's quite calm with that, quite happy, and she lets them fuss her. Rosie also enjoys going through the school hall and hoovering up after lunchtime, Valerie said. The Green Award winners were Kate and Kath from Achieving Results in Communities from Leamington Spa. Kath said, "When we started off, we converted a bit of derelict land into a community woodland, and it's just grown from there. They now run community gardening projects as well as groups for people struggling with their mental health." The Community Group Award went to Emma Stutchbury and Shan Dobinson of Bindley Woods and Woolston Youth Clubs. Ms. Stutchbury said, "This award is not just for us, it's for every youth club that's survived and for every youth club that's restarting and that's going on." The Fundraiser Award went to Martin Brandreth, who runs the Sheepy Ploughing Association Christmas Tractor Run, which has raised more than £85,000 for local charities in 5 years. The event has also become a local tradition, bringing the community together with thousands lining the streets over two nights to see the convoy of 75 tractors decked out in Christmas lights and decorations. The convoy covers Atherston, North Warwickshire, Nuneaton, Bedworth, Coventry and the surrounding villages.
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. And moving on now, we're going to have Hugh with this week's news from the Vision Hub.
Thank you very much. So we're looking forward to Open Day on the 9th of October. We're getting more and more people coming in to take part in that day. So Citizen are going to come along as well. Now, Citizen, as housing. Many of you will know, are the one of the major housing association and social housing providers of Coventry. They also have a branch of what they do, which is to provide support for people, that their tenants, a number of whom obviously have visual impairments. So they're going to come along and have a bit of a table there. Also, the visual and hearing impairment team, so this is Angela, Alison, and Kelly, they will be here as well for almost all the day. So they'll have a table there. So if you've got anything that you need to talk to them about, that would be an ideal opportunity. We're going to have a few other guests once in there. It's not all about other people, though. This is also about the centre, about the hub and everything that we do here. So we're going to have lots of other activities and what have you going on, just to demonstrate everything we've got here. And we'll be talking a bit, I should imagine, about the issues to do with opticians and the referral process into the hospital as well at the moment. So some biggish news, I suppose, that we are haven't had a theatre trip for a little while. The Criterion Theatre is currently undergoing a great deal of renovation, which some of it has not gone entirely smoothly, it has to be said. As with any old building, I live in an old building, work in an old building, you know, everything that can go wrong often does go wrong. So the reopening of the Criterion, which was scheduled for November, has been delayed until later in the year. So the next production we'll be going to see at the Criterion, which is Tommy, is going to be in January. But we have been contacted by the Saints Theatre Company, Saints Drama Company, I should give them their proper title, who operate in Alsley Village, and they put on productions at the Alsley Village Hall. And for their upcoming production in October, they're very kindly having a raffle and collection tins and what have you in favour of Coventry Vision Hub. So we're sending them many great thanks for that. But it also occurred to us, well, why don't we do a theatre trip and go and see the show that they're putting on? So the show that they're putting on is called The Cursed House. It's a proper October thing. It doesn't reach Halloween at all.
It's not cosy crime.
It's not cosy crime. I imagine it'd be quite interesting. But anyway, I'm talking to them. So the date that I've set for that, because of stuff that I need to do, is Friday the 17th of October. So we're going to get some tickets. If you would like to come to see that, we're trying to arrange a touch tour. They've never done touch tours before, but we'll try and sort of help them with that. You know, there's a few things that they want to point out. There's lots of sudden banging sounds, including thunder and lightning and slamming doors. Actors who walk through the beginning of the audience at the beginning of the play, who walk through the audience at the beginning of the play, and a few death scenes, including an asthma attack. But the play is itself is set modern day, and the stories are set up by the caretaker of the house. He tells the date of the story and the characters involved, and then the other actors come on stage to act out the story in that year. After the story, it comes back to the present, and the caretaker gives a bit of a wrap up so that we know what happened to the people involved in the story of that house. So actually, it should be quite accessible, I should think. If you would like to come to that to that production, that performance, which is, say, Friday the 17th. I think it starts at 7:30. We would probably do the touch tour at about 6:30. So what we would probably do is fish and chips somewhere, if we can swing it. We may not be able to swing it. Then go and do the touch tour, and then stay around and watch the play. Alsley Village Hall is, if we get there in time, we can park in the car park. Then it's a relatively easy to get from the car park into the village hall. Otherwise, if we have to park somewhere else, it's a bit of a walk up a slope to get there. So just to let you know if you've got mobility issues. But anyway, we will have a list started at reception. So next time you're in, you can sign up there. Tickets are £8, which is cheaper than at the Criterion. Excuse me. The bus remains £7 there and back. So you can pick up that, and if we do manage to do fish and chips, and we'll let you know about that. Those will be separate as well. I think that's it. If you need, so sign up or give us a call on 024-7671-7522, and let the good people in reception know that you are interested in coming. And that, for the second week in a row.
You're not going to mention Dave?
Oh, gosh, I should have mentioned Dave. Thank you for the heads up. Okay. So Dave Monks, who obviously is very well known to the listeners of Outlook, but he's also very well known to everybody who uses Coventry Vision Hub. He's been a long, long-standing volunteer at the Monday Club and arranges as much of their programme. He was honoured last weekend by Coventry and Warwickshire Radio, BBC Radio, and when he was named, I think it was Good Neighbour of the Year or something, so he got a little plaque presentation award thing, and he beat out some fairly stiff competition to be named as such, because he does work so hard in the community, and so big, massive congratulations to Dave. We appreciate everything that you do here for us at the Hub, and there's so much more that you do outside as well. So congratulations, and well done, Dave.
I would certainly echo that on behalf of Outlook.
Yes, absolutely.
Well. He does an enormous amount. Yeah. Thank you very much, Hugh.
Thank you.
Here's Sarah with this week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, on this week's agenda, we have football, rugby union, a tinsy bit of athletics, before I finish off with something about three-day eventing. You know, the GGs. Right, so where do I start with the football? Well, I'll start with the championship. Coventry City on Saturday took on Norwich City. Now, going into this match, we knew that we had not a good record against them. I think they'd won something like six out of our last seven meetings. So we came out the traces and were so on top. But then, don't you just know it? Their first attempt on goal, and they scored. Norwich 1, Coventry 0. And so they went in at half time. In fact, it was so bad that the BBC commentator actually said, "I can't believe I'm saying this after watching the first half, but Coventry 0, Norwich 1. Oh dear. Now, going into the second half, I'm afraid most of the Norwich players should have had BAFTA awards for good at play acting. I mean, the ref came in for quite a lot of criticism, but in all honesty, he did book six of them, the majority for time wasting. And he can't just say, "Oh, get up, you're not injured." you know, you're just playing for time. Because one day somebody is going to go down and be injured. So 90 minutes came. Ooh, the ref has signalled 9 minutes extra time. Great, he's catching up on all that time wasting. Well, wouldn't you just know it, in the 96th minute, Milan van Avak passed to Hadji Wright, who scored! Goal! Coventry 1, Norwich 1. And despite an absolutely frenetic final last 3 minutes, that was how it finished. Coventry are now fifth in the table and looking good. They still haven't lost a match this season, which is important. Now, their next match will be the grudge match, the Battle of the M69, when we take on Leicester at the King Power in Leicester. Now, that match is a 12:30 kickoff next Saturday, which, as it turns out, is rather good, because, as I'll be saying later, we've got another diary date at 3:30. Now, I've spoken quite a lot about the transfer window. Well, that has now firmly shut, and I'm pleased to say that we held on to both Jack Ridoni and Milan van Avak, but we sold our captain, Ben Sheaf. Now, Ben has been off the field, sidelined with injury for quite a lot of the last season and a bit. And let's be honest, when a cheque for £6.5 million is offered by Wrexham, you know, the side owned and bankrolled by the movie stars, who can refuse it? Thank you very much. That will do nicely. So, what happened to our lower league sides? Well, playing in the FA Cup second qualifying round, Leamington travelled to Alvechurch and must have been fairly confident because Alvechurch are in a lower division. But I'm afraid they were thumped 3-0. But it was better news for Racing Club Warwick because they've gained a replay which will be played tomorrow night as I'm recording, because it's Monday today. So I will bring you the result of that next week. It's also great news for Nuneaton Town, who are way ahead in their league. They still have, after 10 matches, an unbeaten record, although sadly they could only draw midweek 2-2 with Lutterworth Town. So they now have a draw, so they can't claim their 100% record. Oh, well, never mind, Nuneaton. You is looking really good. And how great to be speaking so positively about Nuneaton Football Club. Now, quickly returning to the internationals, you'll remember how underwhelmed I was last week with England's performance against Andorra, where we could only win 2-0. Well, what a difference 3 days makes. And I really think Thomas Tuchel is beginning to find his feet. Something again I didn't say last week when I was wishing he'd Tuchel off home. You know, Thomas is our manager. Well, before I go any further, I mean, Serbia is a battleground when you're playing there. Their last match had to be played behind totally closed doors because of crowd misbehaviour and racist chanting. This time they were allowed 50% capacity, but England still had to contend with remarks, things being thrown. Oh, and the new nicety of green laser pens shot straight in to the England players' eyes. How nice. Anyway, it made no difference because we thumped Serbia 5-0. The commentator said, now, whatever the result is, the English players have got to stay in their seats until all the Serbs have gone out so that they can be escorted by the police out the ground safely. Well, I'm damn sure that after that performance, they didn't care. They were celebrating, and most of the Serbs had gone home anyway. So moving on to rugby union, and I'll do as I've done with the football. I'll start local before going on to the international. Well, Coventry still haven't started their season per se, but they are well into their season of friendlies, warm-up matches, and this time they played a team from the same division as them, so it gave a real indication of where they are, that other team being Coldy. And I'm delighted to say that the final score was Coventry 61, Coldy 26. Well, Coldy, we'll see you at Butts Park Arena again in the season. I bet you can't wait. And now moving on to the Rugby World Cup. Well, we knew that Sunday was going to be an exciting day, but what a day. I mean, Ireland were eventually, unfortunately, beaten, although it was so frustrating because they had led for much of the match, but they just trailed against the French dominance and lost Ireland 13, France 18. Mind you, having said that, one of the French players should really have been sent off because she obviously hadn't read the instructions to have a pre-match snack, you know, something to eat, because she decided to take a chunk, well, bite in, to one of the Irish players' arms, to the effect that, okay, it would be zoomed in, but you could actually see it on the television. Ugh. Anyway, then, so that was one of our British Isles teams out, which finally left England and Scotland. In other words, the roses against the thistles. Well, Scotland had the first score, the first word, scoring from a kick, and we were down 0-3. But don't panic, Sarah, don't panic, because England were just so powerful in pretty much every aspect. And despite having two tries actually disallowed by the TMO for marginal reasons. Oh, the TMO, according to ALEXA, is the television match official. Anyway, they ran out 40 points to 8 winners, Scotland scoring a consolation try, but well into overtime. So what happens next? Well, we are now on to the semi-finals. And on Friday at 7 p.m, in the other side of the draw, New Zealand play Canada. But then, at Saturday at 3:30, England play France. Really glad that football match is 2:30. Yeah. And it's great to see those four sides in the semis because going into the tournament, they were the top four ranked sides in the world. Now, moving on briefly to athletics, we have the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo. And I was hoping to bring you some news of British victories. But to date, we have Great Britain, gold, 0, silver, 0, bronze, 0. I mean, the one thing I will say, although it doesn't excuse them, is that the heat and humidity has been such a major factor in Tokyo, with the temperatures well into the 30s. But having been to Japan, it's not the temperature, it really is the humidity that gets you. I mean, the effect on the athletes could probably best be seen in the men's 10,000 metres, where they positively jogged the first 27 laps. And going into the last 200 metres, they were almost track width, shoulder to shoulder, absolutely sprinting like bats out of hell before the French guy came out the winner. Anyway, hopefully next week I'll have more news to bring you on that. And finally, now this isn't a funny, but it's rather nice. Well, I think it is. Now, you may have seen or heard of the silly signs that people sometimes have in the backs of their cars. Baby on board. I don't know what difference they think it's going to make. Is another driver less likely to crash into them because they have that sign in the back? Well, anyway, whatever reason. Nobody has more of a right to have that pinned to her jacket and her racing silks than Roz Canter. Roz won the Burley horse trials recently, following on from her success at badminton earlier this year. And she's just announced publicly that she's 5 months pregnant. Uh-huh. So she rode that terrifying course, show jumped and did her very neat dressage with a baby on board. So, well done, Roz, and your horse, the lovely name, Lordship's Gruffalo. I tell you this, Roz, after that, giving birth will be a walk in the park. And that has been your sport this week. Have a great week ahead. And don't forget City 12:30 and England Rugby at 3:30 next Saturday. Whew, I'll be exhausted after that lot. Bye.
Thanks to Sarah for the sport, and she signs off with a truly heartfelt comment. Yes, well done, Roz, she says. I don't fancy riding around that cross-country course, let alone doing dressage and show jumping, and I'm not pregnant. Here's Dave Monks with this week's Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag again this week. It's very light though, and I really need your input. You must have got lots of things you can tell your fellow listeners about. If you've heard anything about me being a finalist in the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards, well, you will know what it's all about. But what I really want is for you to make a difference in postbag to other listeners' lives by communicating with them. Over 42 years I've been doing postbag. The majority of contributors have not been public speakers. You don't have to be. Now, John Vale is an exception. I first met him at a friendship club at the Salvation Army, where I was asked to give a talk. I'm pleased to welcome him back with a reply to Graham Whale about the increase in bus fares for those travelling before 9:30 a.m. Here's John Vale to talk about stagecoach bus changes.
Good morning, this is John Vale here. I heard last week about the changes to the concessionary early morning bus passes, but I want you to know that the stagecoach have even worse. Stagecoach make it £3 before 9:30. So if you're going from Coventry on a stagecoach bus, you need to pay £3. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Please speak to us again soon. Regard communicating with your fellow listeners as your mission. And now we have a letter from the wife of Julia's friend, John. It reads, Dear David, this is Jess. John asked me to contact you to let you know that he won't be sending you anything from Julia this week as he is back in hospital again. He had a fall yesterday and he has broken his shoulder. He's also being tested for various other things again. I don't know how long you'll be in for either, but either he or I will be in touch at some point. Well, thank you, Jess. I'm so sorry to hear about John. As I mentioned previously, John is a real stalwart in Postbag. He has been encouraging Julia with the reports for Postbag and giving them his own humorous and often irreverent input as well. I'm sure you have enjoyed them. If you have, tell him now and Julia as well and wish John well. Through his encouragement, we've got to know Julia and the things that she does in life. Without her, you probably wouldn't have heard about VISTA, the Visually Impaired and Sighted Tandem Association, and the Coventry branch of the Torch Fellowship for the Blind. And without Doreen Hilton, you wouldn't know, perhaps, maybe the real reason the resource centres or Coventry Vision Hub's boat trip was cancelled. Maybe it wasn't just the forecast high winds. Here's Doreen.
I have to say, as for the boat trip last Sunday, we was told it was the wind. No, it wasn't was the wind. One of my family, which was my niece, she lived in Leicester for 11 years. I phoned her and I asked her what she thought the situation was. She told me that it was to do with the hot weather on the rivers. They couldn't do any trips or anything like that, because they are completely dried up, right? So this is probably one of the reasons why when the resource centre booked it, which they are naughty really, because they should have explained it. But never mind, we hope that they get more water so they can get it all rolling again. And also, I have another friend too. She lives on the boat side. Her name is Jean. She told me that Leicester was one of the worst places where the rivers dry up. So there we are, folk. I hope that's something that's helped you, all those that planned to go on the boat trip. But I'm sure the resource centre, the staff, will do their help again to get us appointments so we can all book up and go again. Won't it be lovely? I think it will. I'll be one of those who will do it. God bless you all. That's Doreen Hilton.
Thank you, Doreen, for the lowdown on the boat trip. I'm sure the rivers and canals will be full up again with the recent rain, and we'll be able to have the boat trip at last, very soon, hopefully. So don't give up. Well, just recently, there was news about Coventry City Football Club buying a new stadium. But shortly after this news, it was announced that they'd bought the CBS Arena, the rightful home of the Sky Blues, and everybody's happy, including Graham Whale. Here he is to talk about the good news and also the problems of getting a gardener.
Well, first of all, regarding the CBS Arena, yes, I don't really know why they put that story out about them looking for a new 40-seater stadium, being so close to the announcement that they were bought the CBS Arena. I think it was probably meant to distract But yes, we now know they've bought the arena, and I think that's a good move. And I don't know where Doug King gets his money from, but well, he's certainly a king as far as Coventry is concerned. I hope it all works out for the future. Regarding Jag Singh's request for a gardener, the best of luck, mate. I must have tried just about every gardener in Coventry, from the phone book, the research online, leaflets that's come through the doors over the years. About 15 or 20 gardeners I've tried to approach, and the response is always the same. I leave messages which they don't respond to. They don't answer the phone, and the odd occasion when somebody does answer the phone, it's the same old story. Oh, I'm too busy, mate. Can't do it for another 2-3 months. I'm currently relying on a friend who's succumbed his daughter's electronic equipment because he reckons she's not safe with it. So he's offered to do mine to help me out. I am paying him. I insisted on that. But it is, shall we say, a favour, so I can't really recommend him doing your garden. It wouldn't be fair on him, as he's not really a gardener. But I do sympathise with you, Jag, and believe me, if I ever had the opportunity to appear on Paul Moton's programme Room 101, which is highly unlikely, but if I did, one of the first things which would go in Room 101 is professional gardeners, because if they don't want work, they might as well go in Room 101.
Thank you, Graham. It's great news about the Sky Blues having a permanent home now. As far as getting a gardener is concerned, you can tell how quickly people can respond to a request if you ask in Postbag, with Doreen Hilton's recommendation to Jag Singh. Doreen Hilton recommended Mark on 079-0971-3685. It's a shame, Graham, you didn't mention it earlier, as there was a lovely gardener called Lou, who lived about 2 streets away from you, near the top of the hill. I think she stopped being a gardener now, as far as a neighbour of mine is concerned. But Lou, if you remember, did a talk at the Monday Club about colour therapy that she was into then, which I reported on for Outlook. Although there was a little bit of scepticism, there was lovely smells in the Mary Beale day room after she'd sprayed scents around. Something that was appreciated by the late lovely Peggy, who was deafblind and unable to speak. In fact, Postbag has given a voice to people who are deafblind, like Edwina, and also Julia as well, or those with learning difficulties, cerebral palsy, visually impaired, or whatever, over the years. And you, or they, not me, have made a difference. So you don't have to be a great orator, just a willingness to reach out to other listeners and pass on something of yourself for their benefit. You can tell us just what you've been doing in life. Just say hello to people, introduce yourself, and tell us what you've been doing lately, if you've been on holiday and whatever. So you can phone us up on that phone number that people seem to be a bit scared of. That's the Resource Centre or Coventry Vision Hub on 02476 717522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper and start speaking. It's actually quite easy. Okay, and then you can also send an email to postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk, I think it is, but only one person's ever used it, I think. But you can also send me an email, davidmonks46@gmail.com, or you can write a letter. It can either be written by you or someone on your behalf. And there's loads of ways you can contact us. Well, thank you for your messages this week, and please keep this Postbag spot going. Thank you, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all we have from Postbag this week. Dave Monks will be back with your thoughts next week, so keep them coming. Our Warwickshire Wander this week takes us to Knapton on the Hill, in my view one of the most interesting villages in the county, with its 12th century hilltop church and the Oxford Canal skirting the village down below. Elaine is our guide.
For centuries, two buildings have dominated the skyline of Knapton village. High above the houses rise the outlines of the ancient church and the impressive windmill. The angular sails are silhouetted against a background of seasonal skies. They are dramatic against the greyness of winter, or stark before the cloud-scudding cobalt of summer. Seven counties are said to be visible from the top of this 500-foot hill on a fine day, and it is probable that an Iron Age fort once crowned its summit. The name Knapton means a village on the hilltop, from the Anglo-Saxon kneep, meaning hilltop, and tun, meaning settlement. It is recorded as Neptone in the Domesday Book. By the Middle Ages, it had become one of the largest towns in Warwickshire. Unusually, the population was almost the same as today, with approximately 1,000 people living within its boundaries. It possessed at least three manors, and a charter was granted by Edward II in the 14th century, giving it the right to hold a weekly Thursday market and an annual three-day fair, to be held even day and morrow after the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin, which is August the 14th, 15th and 16th. Neither market nor fair exist any longer. In many places in and around Knapton may be seen extensive medieval systems where long departed villagers grew their crops, and it remains basically an agricultural community. Unlike much of Warwickshire, Knapton was not part of the vast Forest of Arden, but was Feldon, or agricultural land, which was not densely wooded. Local houses were stone-built and not timbered, as in neighbouring areas. The de Knapton family lived in one of the long-lost manors until their last heir, a girl named Jaina, married Adam, one of the Shuckburgh family during the 14th century. Since that time, Knapton and Shuckburgh, 2 miles distant, have been linked in many ways and are now part of the same parish group together with neighbouring Stockton. The Church of St. Lawrence dates from the 12th century, was rebuilt in the 13th century and has later additions. Originally the rector of Knapton was the Prior of Coventry, who received its tithes but engaged a vicar to perform its parochial duties. Marks on either side of the chancel arch seem to indicate that the building once possessed a rude screen. Until quite recently, a large gallery stretched across the west end of the building and is remembered by older parishioners. On the vestry door is a strange grille covered by a heavy shutter. Nobody knows the purpose for which it was intended. A spy hole, or maybe a confessional? Who can tell? An ancient wooden chest dated 1624 and given by Thomas and Isabel Garrett of Knapton is one of the church's treasures, rustic in style, but with a tangible link to past worshippers in this holy place. In common with other hilltop villages, there is a legend which tells how the original church was to have been built near to the present village green. Each night, however, the stones which lay ready for construction were transported by fairies or spirits to the summit of Knapton Hill. The villagers took the hint and the church duly arose on the hilltop overlooking the village nestling below, and its squat tower has withstood the buffeting winds for centuries. The church has 6 bells, and these are regularly rung by a team of enthusiastic bell ringers who occasionally enjoy the challenge of a quarter peal. An old set of handbells still exist, and their sweet notes still ring out joyfully at Christmas and other festivals. Napton possesses its very own Christmas carol, entitled Fleecy Care. This was probably written by a local person in the late 18th or 19th century, and it was bellowed out by the local men during the festive season, often after their tonsils had been well oiled with ale. 2 grey-gowned Elizabethan ladies are said to haunt the church. They kneel in the front pew quietly praying. During the early 19th century, a visiting clergyman, the Reverend Augustus Fent, returned late one evening to collect a forgotten cassock, and in the dim light was surprised to see 2 ladies there so late, but he wished them good night and passed on. Next day, he was told that the ghostly parishioners were regular worshippers. Several present-day villagers say they have seen them, but who they are or were, nobody knows. The old Methodist chapel was, until recently, a Nickelodeon theatre, but is now converted into a house. The Christadelphian chapel on Pillowy Green is still in use, and the Congregational chapel is a private house. Chapel Green, on the edge of the village, is named after a 14th century chapel which once stood on the site. Nothing of it now remains, but excavations have revealed Roman and Saxon relics, and it is probable that an earlier village was situated here. Nearby is the old Welsh road, along which drovers walked their cattle from the distant Welsh hills to the markets of Buckingham and London. The most dramatic building in Napton is undoubtedly the windmill, which was restored in recent years. Originally there were 2 mills, and old maps clearly show them situated quite close together. Records of the mill date back to 1543, but it is probable that an earlier mill existed on the site. A spring and well lie within the grounds, going deep down into the hillside and providing a never-failing source of pure water. There is a footpath leading down from the windmill to what used to be the Napton Brick and Tile Works, where a large proportion of villagers used to earn their livings. Bricks and tiles marked with the windmill stamp were produced from local clay and fired in the longest kiln in Europe. They were transported by canal boats, which moored alongside the works on the Oxford Canal. A small industrial site now occupies the site. The Oxford Canal, constructed in the 18th century, sweeps around Napton on 3 sides and is a contour canal and not a cut, as it follows the lowest natural features of the countryside, creating a pleasant meandering route, unlike most other waterways. During the 1950s, the canal was in danger of being abandoned, but the coming of pleasure craft saved its life, and now colourful narrowboats ply its length, and 3 marinas bring pleasure and employment to the area. The Grand Union and Oxford canals join up at Napton, and the old wide basins providing for converging boats remain. Old boatmen, often transporting Napton bricks, use Napton windmill as a landmark. Until 1948, Napton had separate schools for boys and girls, but at that time they amalgamated and became St. Lawrence's Church of England School for mixed infants and juniors. Local secondary schools received the older pupils on them reaching 12. Now that that school has closed and the children transferred to a large new building, opened in 1997, to serve the needs of Napton and surrounding villages, Education has come a long way since children were taught on the stone benches of the church porch. Napton remains a lively and attractive place in which to live, with an active community who enjoy the various clubs and sporting activities, as well as rural pleasures. The Windmill Singers are a local musical group who entertain people all over the county. And every year, a village pantomime is produced, which creates hilarious entertainment for the villagers' enjoyment. An old gentleman of over 80, who had lived in the village all his life, was taken to the village for the very first time when he was nearing 80. On returning home, he was asked his opinion of the mighty ocean, and after pausing, he replied, "It's no better than Napton Resi," which is the local name for the reservoir. Like that old man, many people living in Napton feel that it is a beautiful and impressive place to live, and one which bears comparison with other lovely Warwickshire villages. The folk who live on the hill welcome you to their village.
Not many of these to be found in Warwickshire waterways. Nigel tells us about shore crabs, shy seaside charmers with a sideways shuffle. This is taken from the Landscape magazine.
At the far end of a long sandy beach, where the arm of a rocky headland reaches out to embrace the bay, two people are crouched over a rock pool left by the outgoing tide. The grandfather points something out to the small girl beside him. Gently, he moves a stone in the pool, allowing his granddaughter to see the scuttling motion of a shore crab as it moves sideways through the clear water to another hiding place. Intrigued, the child reaches into the water herself and lifts another small rock, but the crab is well hidden in a cranny now, and the tide is on the turn. Carefully, they replace the stones and stand up. Memories have been made, and the child's first encounter with the secret haunts of a shore crab will stay with her forever. There are more than 60 species of crab to be found around the British coastline, and the fellow encountered in the rock pool, a green shore crab, is the most abundant. They are found all round Britain and Ireland, along shorelines in the shallowish waters, although they have been found at depths of up to 200 feet, as well as in estuaries. In some ways, they are ambassador crabs, the species most often encountered in childhood, sparking interest in these curious crustaceans. Although termed green, their colouring is variable throughout their life stages, aiding camouflage. The young crabs can be quite mottled, with adults ranging from dark green with blobs of brown to shades of orange and red. The crab's carapace, or shell, gives the animal its distinctive shape, being much wider than it is long. The male shore crab can grow up to 3.5 inches, 9 centimetres. Females are a little smaller. Their wide, flattish shape enables them to burrow into sand or squeeze into narrow crannies. The front of the shore crab shell looks serrated, with 5 spiky points on each side and 3 more rounded lobes between the very mobile combined eyes, each of which comprises a huge number of light sensors. Each of these tiny eyes has its own lens and cornea, so the crab sees a mosaic of images. Different species of crab live at different depths, and generally those crabs of deeper waters have larger eyes to make the most of the available light. They breathe through gills. They use the senses of touch, taste, sight and smell to go about their crabby business, and although their hearing is not acute, it is thought they can pick up nearby mid to low frequency sounds. Receptors are found on their antennae as well as other parts of their body. Different receptors can detect a variety of stimulants, allowing the crab to pick up information about its surrounding environment. Despite their primitive appearance, studies have shown crabs to display quite complex brain function, with the ability to find and remember the way around the complicated three-dimensional watery spaces in which they live. To the casual observer, crabs may appear to have 10 legs and range in pairs. However, only 8 of these are walking legs. The front pair of appendages are the crab's pincers, or cellae. The crab's shell shape restricts its leg movements. They can only shuffle slowly forwards. This is made up for by their ability to scamper sideways relatively quickly. The second joint of each leg is hinged and can bend sideways, enabling them to move away from children or to grab food. The shore crab is unfussy in its diet and will eat whatever its chances upon, including seaweed, mussels, barnacles, bits of bacon on crab fishing lines, and so on. It will also occasionally eat smaller crabs and tends to forage at night during high tide. As a young crab grows, it molts to accommodate its increasing body size. If conditions are good, it will molt many times during its first year, with the frequency of molting slowing down as it matures, at which point it molts once a year. Phenomenal communication comes into play during mating, signalling to a male that the female is approaching readiness. Males have larger pincers than the females. These are used to compete for a wife. A usual trick that a crab keeps up its sleeve is the ability to regrow a claw lost in a fight. A male may mate with several females, and unpartnered males may try to displace a male which is already in the precocular stage, which means that it is carrying a female beneath his body, waiting for her to molt. The male tends to choose a female with a smaller carapace than his own. After she molts, he will flip her over to mate while her new shell is still soft. A female shore crab produces a staggering 185,000 eggs. They are carried in an orange mass beneath her abdomen, which is broader than the male's, and the eggs darken as they mature. Females carrying eggs are termed buried, and their phase can last for up to 4 months, the duration depending on the prevailing temperature. In time, the eggs are ready to hatch into larvae. Mother crabs living in tidal estuaries will travel coastwards by night to release their larvae into the fully salinated water at the estuary mouth. The larvae, or zoe, are spiny, transparent, and free-swimming. They disperse with the offshore water currents, becoming part of the oceanic plankton that is such a crucial element to the marine food chain. Zoe develop in several stages before going through a final molt to become juvenile crabs. Young crabs live within the protection of seaweeds and sea grasses until they achieve maturity. The crab has many predators in addition to humans. Shore crabs are predated by fish and sea or estuary birds such as gulls and eider ducks. It's not unusual to see a herring gull flinging a hapless crab about along the waterline. Further up a river estuary, they may even be predated by otters. Shore crabs are also under threat from parasites called the crab hacker barnacle, which uses the crab as a host for its eggs. Pollution is a major threat, and not solely chemical pollution. Plastic pollution and light pollution around our brightly lit shoreline impacts their behaviour and metabolism. It has been shown that shore crabs, exposed to the noise of ships, have a reduced capacity to change colour, affecting their potential camouflage and rendering them more visible to predators. The reduction in seagrass meadows also removes the habitat in which many young crabs, as well as their marine wildlife, find shelter. For now, our shore crabs remain widespread, and as long as humans learn to tread more lightly on the planet and to treat natural habitats and their inhabitants with respect, then generations of youngsters will come to be able to share the memorable moment of spotting the first sideways scurrying shore crab in the rock pools of the future.
It's full steam ahead, as always, for our enduring love and fascination with steam railways. This is part one of a two-part feature written by Karen Rocket for the Daily Express and read by Bill.
Tom, who works full-time as an instructor teaching new drivers on the Tyne and Wear Metro, admits it isn't always easy to find time for his passion. We've all got lives. I probably spend about a day and a half a week volunteering at Tanfield, but there is life beyond trains, although don't quote me on that. Sophie Martin, 30, is another volunteer of Tom's age, who, like him, fell in love with steam as a child. She has qualified as a fireman, but as the only female in such a role at Tanfield, she would love to see more women involved. "I think the fireman is the most fun job you can have operating a steam train," she says. "You are responsible for two things, fire and water. I think people misconceive it as putting out fires, but it's the exact opposite. You are making them." Sophie's dad was an electrical engineer who built a model railway in the Midlands, so she grew up around engines. But it was a visit to the National Railway Museum in York, aged 8, and standing on the footplate of the Mallard that inspired her to want to become a fireman. "I was handed a shovel, and I knew from that moment what I wanted to do," she beams. "I'm currently the only female fireman up here, and I recognised as a teenager it wasn't the standard thing for girls to like trains, and I took a step back from it. But now I have completely re-embraced it, and I am proud to say I love steam trains, and I would absolutely love for more females to get involved." Sophie celebrated her 30th birthday with a tea party in a carriage with her railway family. A manager for Amazon and an army reservist too, she still manages to find time for Tanfield. It helps that her husband-to-be, David Allinson, is a volunteer train driver and inspector on the railway, sharing her passion for steam. "It's a male-dominated world, but I have achieved what I have here on my own merit, and I would urge other girls interested in trains to do the same," she says. "You don't have to come from a railway background or to be a man to enjoy steam trains," Tom adds. "Not all heritage railwaymen have so many young volunteers or women as we do at Tanfield, and I think it's pretty special for us. We want different kinds of people from all walks of life to volunteer on these railways. It's nice to see different people enjoying steam trains, not just the stereotypical train enthusiasts like me." Some 170 people volunteer at Tanfield, and there are also 3 full-time members of staff, including General Manager David Watchman. He has been responsible for coordinating a number of events for Tanfield's 300th anniversary year, which are essential for raising funds towards the £500,000 minimum needed each year to keep it going. "I'm really proud of our railway. We have a fantastic bunch of volunteers," he says. "Everyone has their own skill set. It's all about the people, and we have volunteers aged 12 through to 92. The railway wouldn't exist without them. In the past 50 years, we have restored 3 miles of tract, restored numerous engines and carriages, built stations and all the infrastructure. So much has been achieved. I have been around railways since the age of 7. I've grown up with them, and I've made lots of memories, made lots of friends, and learned lots of new skills. It's the place I call home, really." David's father, Colin, was a volunteer guard at the railway, but in 2021 he suffered a fatal heart attack at the East Tanfield station, the railway's southern terminus. For a while, David found it difficult to be at the railway, but says he is creating new memories at Tanfield with his son, Rory, 3, born after Colin died. Rory didn't really have any choice when it came to liking trains, but like so many of the volunteers here, he is growing up with them. He recognises the different engines now, and basically likes anything that moves and makes a noise. "Like Tom and David and Sophie, it looks like trains may end up being Rory's story too. It's the sights, the sounds, the smells, and what your parents take you to when you're younger, Tom enthuses. It could have been classic cars, I suppose, but I am called Thomas, so it was meant to be.
This week, Dave takes himself to one of the biggest music events in this part of the Midlands, Warwick Folk Festival. I spent an evening at this year's festival myself, watching the frankly incredible singer, songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson.
Hello there! That's the sound of a banjo at the Warwick Folk Festival, and that's John playing the banjo. Brilliant! And there's a musical workshop taking place. That's wonderful. People playing different instruments, violins and tuba, the drums. Well, this is, I can't believe it's not folk. People dressed up in 60s clothes and singing versions of 60s songs. We're going to hear from Daisy Bell.
Tonight you're mine completely. Tonight you're mine. You give your love so sweetly. Tonight the light of love is in your eyes. In your eyes.
I'm in a tent at the moment. I'm speaking to Karen Pfeiffer and the partner Paul Walker.
Right. Hello there. Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Now you've been singing as Joan Baez. So what was there was a competition, wasn't there?
That's right. Yes, it's every year, and it's led by a gentleman called Keith Donnelly.
Yeah.
And it's called I Can't Believe It's Not Folk.
Yeah.
Because of course this is a folk festival, and they have got this fun competition. And this year the theme was the 1960s. So we decided to go as Joan Baez, and Paul was Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, fantastic.
But we decided to take one of Bob Dylan's songs and make a bit of a spoof comedy story out of it in relation to the folk festival. So we call it, instead of It Ain't Me Babe, we call it It Ain't Folk Babe. And that's what we did. And it went very well.
Are you a Morris dancer?
Yes, I'm a Morris dancer from Brasstown, North Carolina.
From where?
Brasstown, North Carolina, USA.
Hey, fantastic! Really? Yeah, you've come a long way.
We've come a long way. There's 35 of us here.
Yeah? Fantastic. Can you describe how you dress, please?
Well, these are rag coats.
The rag coats.
It's hard to show the rag coats on a microphone, but visualize going to a secondhand store and buying a bunch of clothing.
Yeah.
Cutting it up into strips and sewing it to a jacket. That's what it looks like.
And you've got a black hat and you've got flowers all around it.
Yes. We all dress in different hats. My wife here has a hat on.
Hello.
And has a gorilla on top.
So what's your name?
I'm Joe Zhang.
And what's your name?
Janice Lessard.
Wow. So how do you feel about coming to Warwick Folk Festival and taking part in it?
Oh, it's wonderful. I love this folk festival. Really nice. A lot of fun.
So have you come specially for the folk festival?
Yes. We came all the way here to go to the Warwick Folk Festival, and we're going to Sidmouth next weekend.
Wow.
Well, I hope you enjoy it. It seems to be.
Yes, thank we you. Are. We are.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much indeed.
We're having a wonderful time. The people here are being very nice to us.
Yeah, so how popular is Morris Dancy in the United States?
Not
more than British scene.
Yeah, it's not very well known. There's a few different areas in the country they do it. Where we live, there's a folk school near us. And so they've brought in a lot of different things because of that. So that's how we got started with Morris Dancing. They started the group about 30 years ago at the folk school.
That's amazing.
At John C. Campbell Folk School
in Brasstown, North Carolina.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Thank you.
Well, there's a great atmosphere at the Warwick Folk Festival. Lots of tents selling things, and there's some stick dancers that have just been taking place, and everybody's friendly. Really great. Hey, I'm speaking to Jane and my oldest son Paul, who's in a duo, a folk duo called Yonderlands. What do you think of the festival, Paul?
It's been a really great festival. What's particularly nice for me is bumping into all my friends who are all here, all very talented people, watching Keith Donnelly's Not a Folk Song competition earlier, and our friend Maria Barham won that. Just sitting here with my dad being interviewed, that's obviously a thing that's happened. We bought a few instruments along the way, of course that was going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just been really chilling and enjoying the atmosphere.
Yeah. And Jane, you two belong to a folk club, don't you? And there's also that's on Thursday night.
We do. We kind of run the Stump Folk Club, which is at the Humber Pub in Coventry, which meets every Thursday, usually for a sing-around, just where everybody comes, brings their own instruments, we take turns singing songs that everyone can join in, and sometimes, occasionally we do have a proper paid guest artist, but not so often these days, but it's usually a sing-around, it's great fun, we have lots of laughs, and everybody has a go, which is really important with music, is just to have a go. Even if you're not very, very good, it doesn't matter, just give it a go. I'd say to any of your listeners out there, if you have any chance to access music, whether it's just singing or whether it's playing an instrument, just have a go.
That's the main thing. And the Tump Folk Club meets at the Humber Pub on a Thursday night about 8 o'clock, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And there's also a sing-around at the Humber Pub on a Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock.
Yes, there is, and it's good. Even more informal than the Thursday night one.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of different people come to the Sunday one compared to the Thursday one, and it's a chance for people to try out new songs that they might have been wanting to learn, or ones they've just written, or if they've got some songs that they haven't sung for a long time and they just want to knock the dust off them, they can come and do that, and it's very supportive. Everybody helps everybody out. And again, we just have lots of laughs and lots of fun.
That's great. That's the main thing. Thank you very much, Jane and Paul. Thank you. Oh, Yonderland. Thank you.
Home, hope on the sea, angels of mercy, answer our plea, and carry us home. Home, hope on the sea, carry them safely home from the sea. Thank you very much, thank you.
We're four sailors just skipping round the top, and the land lovers lie down below, and the land lovers lie down below.
Well, it's been really great, the Folk Festival. So that's cheerio from the Warwick Folk Festival. Bye for now.
From live music to TV ads, from the Milky Bar Kid to the PG Tips Chimps, some classic television advertising has created lifelong memories. This is taken from the Women's Weekly and read by Nigel.
Whether it's chocolate bars or instant mash, from the moment the first grainy black and white commercials appeared on our television screens almost 70 years ago, there have been dozens of ads that have stuck in our heads. Obviously, advertisers make us pay attention by creating novelty, a memorable tagline, or characters you can relate to, explains Julie Beard, Director of Research at consumer insight agency Mindlab. But classic ads can also become part of your childhood memories, creating a direct connection to where you were at that point in your life. How many of these following do you remember? Firstly, a slice of nostalgia. The Hovis Boy on the Bike commercial was twice voted the nation's favourite advert. Set in post-war Britain, it showed a flat-capped delivery boy struggling to push a bike with a basket full of freshly baked bread up a street's steep cobbles before freewheeling back down with the Ashington Colliery brass band playing in the background. Although implied to be in the north of England, it was actually filmed on Gold Hill in Shaftesbury in Dorset. Carl Barlow, who was 13 at the time, reckons he got the part because out of the final three boys auditioned, one couldn't ride a bike and the other refused to have a pudding-based haircut. What about Bar None? Over five decades, there have been no less than 10 blonde-haired Milky Bar kids dressed as a cowboy, each one sported a large white Stetson, round wide-frame glasses and a sheriff badge, and rode into town to save the day, dishing out chocolate bars and delivering the catchphrase, "The Milky Bars are on me." The advert proved so popular that after its 1961 debut, sales almost doubled over the next 3 years. And what of the fairy wand? Thanks to Fairy Liquid's iconic washing up ads, we all know that hands that do dishes can feel soft as your face. When the ads started back in the 1960s, they featured a mother at the kitchen sink doing the dishes with her daughter watching nearby. For actor Leslie Ash, then four, it provided one of her first roles, and in the 1980s, actor Nanette Newman became the face of the brand. In 2013, there was even a court case into Fairy's claim to last twice as long as rival brands, but the investment watchdog ruled in its favour. What about animal magic, then? Some of the best-loved and longest-running ads of all time featured the tea-guzzling PG Tipster chimpanzees in a series of sketches dressed as humans. The first commercial, A Chimp's Tea Party, voiced by actor Peter Sellers, aired in 1956, and their monkeying around earned them a Guinness World Record for the most enduring TV commercial stars. The chimps, all originally trained by Twycross Zoo in Leicestershire, were seen moving furniture, serving in the army, and cycling in the Tour de France. Each chimp reportedly earned over £1,000 per commercial, with the money going to support the zoo, although it's now recognised that using the chimps did cause them problems in later life. And finally, Smash Hit. The iconic "For Mash, Get Smash" Martians landed on our screens in 1974, advertising instant mashed potato. To fits of metallic laughter, they discussed how primitive earthlings still peeled spuds with metal knives, boiled them for 20 earth minutes, and then smashed them to bits. It took three puppeteers hidden underneath the set to move each robot, but one of the ad's most memorable moments happened accidentally when a puppet fell sideways laughing and it was left in. The ad sent sales of Smash into orbit, and unauthorized models of the Martians were even made out of car parts by workers on the production line at Ford's Halewood factory in Liverpool.
And that just about brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.